This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We tend to latch on to big, visible, salient disasters as opposed to the sort of slow, grinding impacts of the day-to-day life. The reality is that every day, more people are poisoned and impacted by fossil fuels than are impacted in the case of Fukushima.
The meltdown at the nuclear power plant in Fukushima is enlivening discussions on alternative energy around dinner tables and across debate platforms everywhere. People who call themselves environmentalists tend to agree on the need to curtail human reliance on fossil fuels, including the pervasive use of coal in generating electricity. That same level of consensus cannot be found, however, on the topic of nuclear power. Nuclear energy and environmentalism have traditionally been thought of as incongruous, yet our guest today on Sea Change Radio offers a logic to solve the paradox. Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Policy at the Breakthrough Institute, a think tank that advocates for innovative solutions to energy and climate challenges, believes that nuclear power ought to be a significant part of a more sustainable energy plan. Listen as I ask him about the risks, real and perceived, and how the catastrophe in Japan affects his views on nuclear power. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Jesse Jenkins. He's the Director of Energy and Climate at the Breakthrough Institute, which is a nonprofit, independent public policy think tank. Jesse, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on the program.
First, tell us, what is the Breakthrough Institute and what is your mandate as an organization?
The Breakthrough Institute is based in Oakland, California, and we're a nonprofit research and policy organization, a think tank, essentially. And our broad mandate is focused on sort of reinvigorating and rethinking liberal thought for the 21st century. Our climate and energy program, which I direct, is primarily focused on developing and advancing the policy solutions that can help make clean energy cheap, that's affordable enough to compete with fossil fuels and make oil and coal obsolete while still powering global development throughout the world.
So is it correct to say that the Breakthrough Institute used to not have a specific stance on nuclear power, Jesse, but in the last few years, your organization's views have evolved to actually begin advocating for nuclear energy?
Yeah, more or less. Our views have certainly evolved quite a bit about nuclear power over the last 2 years, both mine individually as well as the rest of our staff and our organization's position here.
Why is that?
What's happened is as we've really come to grasp and wrestle with the true scale of the global energy and climate challenge, the sheer amount of low carbon or zero carbon energy that's required to avert climate risks, get us off of coal and oil, and still be able to meet what is really rapidly growing global energy demand. We've recognized that that challenge alone is already quite difficult. Trying to do it without nuclear power makes that challenge probably close to impossible. And so that forced us all to look much more closely at nuclear power, which we were all pretty agnostic about, or if not skeptical of. And the reality is the more we researched nuclear power, more we understood the relative risks and benefits and how those compare to the other sources of energy that we have at our disposal. The more you know, the less you're worried about climate change. The less you're worried about nuclear power. And so we've been compelled to share what we've learned about the relative risks, partly because the common understanding amongst many about the risks of nuclear power is often quite divergent from the reality and lacking in the context of our global energy system and the risks that that entails. So,
and one of the reasons we're having this discussion is that we both are trying to grapple with this disaster in Japan. We came together over Twitter. You're a avid Twitterer. People can follow you at Jesse Jenkins.
At Jesse Jenkins.
You're definitely covering that on a minute-to-minute basis. How has the recent disaster helped inform your opinions about nuclear energy?
Yeah, I think overall, my general position on nuclear power hasn't really changed due to Fukushima and the nuclear crisis that's unfolded there. In some ways, it's actually been confirmed. I think that what we have to be clear about is the relative risks here. In normal day-to-day operations, this is putting aside disaster scenarios, in normal day-to-day operation of a nuclear power plant, as well as the normal day-to-day storage and management of waste that comes from nuclear power plants, no one is killed or harmed. Radiation is contained. The impact on the public health is essentially zero. Now contrast that to the normal day-to-day impacts of our coal and oil-powered economies, where globally, hundreds of thousands of people die every year from air pollution from coal and oil. Those sources are the leading causes of smog and acid rain, mercury contamination, which causes mental retardation in children, and bioaccumulates in the food chain.
Minor safety.
Regular accidents occur throughout the production process that kill or maim dozens and hundreds each year. And of course, climate change, which is principally caused by our combustion of fossil fuels. So that's the normal day-to-day operation of our fossil fuel system versus our nuclear power system. Okay, so that's important context. Now, moving on to a crisis situation, a disaster, we see that Fukushima is the second worst nuclear crisis or disaster in the history of the nuclear power industry.
To date.
It's really only one of three globally in 60 years of operation. The reality is that it's a bad situation. It is a serious industrial disaster. But when compared to other industrial disasters, it actually doesn't rank very high in the scale of industrial disasters.
How many people died in Bhopal?
So exactly, 4,000 people or more, the government says maybe 15,000, the government in India, died in the Bhopal chemical disaster there. Just, you know, we all watched in horror at as the Deepwater Horizon disaster spewed, you know, contaminants into the Gulf of Mexico for months on end. It killed 11 workers and injured 15 more. The Kingston, Tennessee breach of a coal slurry impoundment dumped billions of gallons of toxic coal ash over 400 acres, including contamination of the Clinch River. There are any number of industrial disasters that rank higher or equal to the disaster at Fukushima. And that's important to note as well, because we regularly tolerate the risks of these other disasters. But there's something particular about nuclear power that draws a certain elevated level of fear.
Where do you think that stems from? The Cold War, maybe?
Part of it is the association with nuclear weapons, which is a pretty weak association. I think the other part is that that radiation itself is poorly understood. And is by the public, and it's invisible. There's something sort of nefarious about the sense that there's this invisible sci-fi type, contamination that could get you before you even know it's there, and that's, you know, that's a scare. The other thing is that there's sort of a big visceral nature to these crises, and we blow it up in the national news. Everybody knows about Chernobyl. Everybody knows about Fukushima. Everybody knows about Three Mile Island. It's similar to the way in which we are more worried about plane crashes, since they're so public and hundreds of people die at once, than we are about the regular grinding death from traffic accidents, you know, which kill many, many more times the number of people per vehicle mile traveled than air travel does. We tend to latch on to big, visible, salient disasters as opposed to the sort of slow, grinding impacts of the day-to-day life. The reality is that every day more people are poisoned and impacted by fossil fuels than are impacted in the case of Fukushima. This is something that has compelled us to, you know, actually get past our kind of initial conceptions about nuclear power, to look deeply at the scientific literature about the epidemiological risk and impact on human health from radiation, the true impact from Chernobyl, which is really the worst case scenario from a nuclear plant.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Getting numbers about the true impact of Chernobyl is... There's a UN study that found 43 people died from it, and then there's another study, I forget the organization, that said 985,000 died. So somewhere in between, can inform one's opinion on whether or not they believe these fears are founded or not.
So all of these wild numbers that are really spooky, I mean, it's a scare, that makes it sound really tremendous. That comes from one study that was actually commissioned by Greenpeace International, a longtime anti-nuclear campaigning group, and was performed by a Ukrainian researcher that essentially involves a survey of a bunch of literature and uses methodologies that are widely divergent from the standard scientific methods and the standard methods of epidemiological study. The researchers in the Greenpeace commissioned report rejected all of those standard methods. For that reason, the National Institutes of Health published a review of the study that cautioned readers against the findings because they are widely different from the standard scientific methods, the standard epidemiological research methods. Now, I heard Helen Caldicott, the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, on Democracy Now! Recently, and she's been on other media outlets, talking up this report, saying it actually might be 2 million people eventually. Her contention is literally that there is a worldwide global conspiracy commissioned by the World Health Organization, the UN Environment Program, the UN Commission on the Scientific, the UN Scientific Committee on the Impacts of Ionizing Radiation, and the UN General Assembly to hush and hide the real human health impacts from Chernobyl. I have no doubt that Helen Caldicott believes what she's saying. Sure. But we have to recognize that in order to believe that, you have to believe that there is a conspiracy perpetrated by the joint UN scientific research agencies, including those who are primary purpose is to protect public health, to somehow cover all this up in order to support the nuclear energy industry. Now, as I said, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a researcher, a health researcher. I'm also not a climate scientist. And I've learned, though, in recent years, as a climate policy analyst, to trust the wide body of scientific consensus by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change about climate science. And most climate campaigners and advocates and you know citizens worried about climate change do as well. And they're worried when people cherry-pick evidence, when they grab the outlying scientists, even if they are scientists or climate scientists, when they tout their one study that says something wildly divergent. We know that we have to be skeptical of those outlying positions. And that's exactly the case here. And I just find it very hard to believe that there would be a conspiracy perpetrated by the UN Environment Program and the World Health Organization to put people in harm's way and to hide the risks. You know, I have to stick with the consensus scientific position on this, which is that about 54 people have died to date from the disaster at Chernobyl. About 4,000 to 9,000 cases of cancer are ultimately likely fatal cancer. And several thousand more are likely to have contracted treatable thyroid cancer, mostly children. Now, that's a serious, serious disaster. We have to consider Chernobyl in context as well. This really is the worst case scenario that could ever result from nuclear power plants, because this was a design that was known to be dangerous. It had a high sort of runaway risk factor that the energy would build up if there was a loss of control. They were running the reactor at full speed when this crisis occurred. There was no containment structure designed to contain the release of radiation in the case of a disaster. All plants in the United States, Germany, Japan, elsewhere in the developed world, and developing countries all have containment structures to prevent this kind of situation and all use much safer designs. So this was really the worst case scenario. It was in a Stalinist society in which the government didn't do the kind of precautionary things that you would do in this scenario, prevent children from drinking contaminated milk, distribute iodine pills. So this is really the worst case scenario, and Fukushima is unlikely to even closely approach the disaster there, even though it still ranks as the second worst disaster behind Chernobyl.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. You're listening to my discussion with Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Policy at the Breakthrough Institute. Be sure to tune in next week as Solar Executive Danny Kennedy offers a contrasting perspective on nuclear power. Now back to my discussion with Jesse Jenkins. The other thing that Helen Caldicott mentioned, which kind of made me cynical, I'm always wary of someone who says, well, the nuclear industry has bought these people or something like that. But this mythical nuclear industry being this all-powerful, how powerful could it be in the U.S. when there hasn't been a new nuclear plant built in the last 30 years?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, the nuclear industry is obviously an industry. It's got, you know, money to spend on lobbying. It does not spend anywhere near as much as the fossil fuel industry. And at this point, it's probably comparable to the advocacy of renewables industry, which has been far more effective in securing subsidies and mandates and policies to support renewables. The nuclear industry, from everything I hear, and this is no, you know, they may find this offensive, but everything I hear, they're a relatively ineffective lobbying force in Washington. And I think that is evidenced by the fact that whereas there are many proposals to help move them forward, there has been very little concrete policy that has resulted in any new significant renaissance of nuclear power in the United States.
There is one troubling new nuclear plant that's being proposed not so far from here in Fresno. I don't know if you've been following that, which they're trying to get around the moratorium by calling it a desalination plan. I don't know enough about it, but it sounds a little wacky. And the guy who's proposing it is saying this will create jobs which will reduce violence against women.
Are you familiar I'm not familiar with that. I mean, I think that California should revisit its moratorium. I've seen research by Lawrence Livermore National Lab scientists, looking at what it would really take to get to the California's 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050, which is our long-term objective. It's practically impossible to do that without nuclear power.
And without nuclear power right now, we don't have the online capacity to replace that with renewables, unfortunately.
Yeah. The American Wind Energy Association, the industry lobby group for the wind industry, and the Department of Energy published a study a couple years ago, which looked at how much wind could scale up to provide our energy by 2030. And the estimate of the industry itself and the Department of Energy was that if everything goes right, wind power, which is the most affordable and scalable of our current renewable technologies, could provide about 20% of the nation's electricity by 2030.
Well, when you look at T. Boone Pickens's plan, which he kind of has shelved a little bit. The issue is not just the farms as much as the transmission lines.
There's a lot of things in terms of transmission and siting and policy that have to all go right to make sure that we can get to 20% by 2030. But even that would be just about enough, a little bit more than you'd need to fully phase out and replace our nuclear power fleet, which provides about 20% of our energy today.
So what's the other 80%?
If we do that, we have no net benefit from a climate perspective. We've phased out our largest source of low-carbon power and replaced it with a new source of low-carbon power. We still have all of our coal plants online. We still have all of our natural gas plants.
George Monbiot wrote that the Fukushima disaster actually made him more pro-nuclear because how often are you going to get this perfect storm, so to speak, of a 9.0 subduction earthquake and a huge tsunami?
Yeah, a 45-foot tsunami.
And an aging power plant and still the worst case scenario is looking a lot less worse than the thousands of people that have been killed by the tsunami.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, we have to keep that in context as well. I mean, this was a massive natural disaster, a double whammy, you know, earthquake and huge tsunami hitting an area of low-lying coastal plains. I mean, the entire region is devastated. And Fukushima is not the only industrial site damaged by this. There was a dam that burst in Fukushima Prefecture, not far from the plant. Reports are that it wiped away 1,800 homes and probably killed, we don't know how many because they're not accurate reports. There was a refinery that's natural gas stores were on fire for over a week, spewing toxins into the area right in the middle of Chiba City. And there were probably over 20,000 people killed. There was a high-speed rail line, a train that's gone completely missing. It's presumed that 400 people on board are gone. They're dead. So this is, you know, we live in industrial societies. We put infrastructure in harm's way, at risk of natural disasters. And we do our best in an industrialized society to prepare for that. Now, Japan did pretty well. A tenth as many people are likely to have died in a much worse earthquake in Japan than it died in Haiti. Same ratio, 20,000 people in Japan, 250,000 people died from the East Asian tsunami. So there's a level of industrial development that requires affordable energy to attain that actually reduces our vulnerability to these disasters. Japan has no other resources. Nuclear power there's a reason they've chosen nuclear power despite the risks. They have no fossil fuel resources. If you tried to provide the same amount of energy as Japan currently gets from its nuclear power fleet from solar photovoltaics, it would take between a third and half of the land area of Japan. So they don't have many other options. And the energy provided by their nuclear fleet is, A, it's low carbon. It's critical to meeting their climate objectives. They've actually set a goal to expand their nuclear fleet to 50% of their electricity from about 30% today. And it provides a critical, reliable energy source in a country where they have very few options other than to import fossil fuels at high cost. Just a slice of copper. Blue. To hear my words.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. You're listening to my discussion with Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Policy at the Breakthrough Institute. Be sure to tune in next week as Solar Executive Danny Kennedy offers a contrasting perspective on nuclear power. Now back to my discussion with Jesse Jenkins. What do you think the chances of a expansion of nuclear power in this country are in light of the current disaster in Japan?
My colleagues Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger and I wrote a piece in the Atlantic Monthly about that question. And our thinking is actually that the Fukushima crisis is unlikely to change the overall trajectory of nuclear power in the world. That's because in the developed countries with relatively flat demand for energy like the United States or Germany, there wasn't a big push to build nuclear power plants. The United States has a couple plants moving forward, maybe up to six others that are on, sort of being proposed. It's not a huge renaissance, a huge boom in nuclear power construction. And, those six plants may get reduced to two or four in the U.S., but it's not a huge change here. Germany was debating whether or not to keep its old plants online or not, not whether or not to build new ones.
Can you talk about the new generation of new ones? They don't take 10 years to build.
Well, there's a couple different. There are newer, safer versions of our existing nuclear reactors, our large, 1,000 megawatt scale. These are enough to power a whole city with each one of these, medium-sized city. There are newer designs that are safer, that have passive safety systems involved so that if a crisis happens like Fukushima, they don't need active electricity to pump coolant through for a period of time. Things that are much safer than the plants at Fukushima, but are largely the same kind of design, and they're big, and they do take a while to construct. And they require, just because of their massive size, they require a significant capital outlay of, many billions of dollars, and that makes them difficult to finance. They're having a tough time getting those plants built just because of the large amount of capital needed to do it. There are newer, smaller, modular reactors that are being proposed by several companies that are much smaller scale. So instead of 1,000 megawatts or 1,600 megawatts, they're more like 40 megawatts. They're the size of sort of a large wind farm, the same amount of energy the wind farm puts out, except that they have a very small footprint. These plants could be financed for, a few hundred million dollars a piece as opposed to a few billion dollars a piece. They can be manufactured in assembly line manner, the major components, and shipped to the site, which reduces the construction time. And if you can achieve economies of scale in manufacturing, could significantly reduce the cost as well. And many of them incorporate the same kind of passive safety systems that make this new generation much safer. We think there's a lot of potential for small modular reactors to play a significant role, but right now they're still at least 5 years out as far as working their way through the regulatory process, getting the first plants built. We think that we should be serious about moving those forward.
In the U.S.? Or
in the U.S.,
and
yeah.
Have some of these small, can you give us some examples of these small modular plants overseas?
China is actively pursuing what's called a gas-cooled pebble bed reactor. That's a design initially pioneered in South Africa, and it's the focus of research has moved to China recently. And they plan to have a pilot plant online by 2014. And knowing their pace of operation, they likely will do that. Japan has been developed. A couple of Japanese companies have very small modular reactor designs. It's not clear if they're moving forward to build those. Russia is building a design that actually floats on a barge. And can be then shipped to disaster sites or to developing countries to provide power.
Almost like an extension of the nuclear submarine?
Yeah, exactly. It's the same, it's a nuclear-powered ship, just the way our nuclear submarines and our aircraft carriers and some of our battleships are powered by small nuclear reactors. In fact, in disaster scenarios like Haiti, the nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that were dispatched to the area to help were able to provide desalination services to provide potable drinking water in disaster scenarios. If you hooked up a power line, they could even provide electricity. And then in India, they're pursuing what's called a thorium molten salt reactor, which is something we keep hearing from engineers that has a lot of potential. It uses natural thorium as opposed to enriched uranium as its fuel. Thorium is in plentiful quantities in the world. There's no shortage of thorium. It's sort of proliferation proof in that the byproducts of it are difficult, if not impossible, to divert to nuclear weapons material.
So it doesn't sound like it's a moribund industry as a legacy of the 60s by any means.
No, the reality is that the opposition to nuclear power stopped some of these more advanced designs from going into service. And so we've had to rely on the current generation of plants probably longer than we would have necessarily had to if a new generation was coming online afterwards.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Climate at the Breakthrough Institute. So when you hear the nightmare scenarios of Fukushima leading to massive radiation, which will render the island of Japan uninhabitable for the foreseeable future, I keep scratching my head thinking, well, not only was there two nuclear bombs dropped on major population centers 70 years ago, there was also lots and lots of nuclear testing during the Cold War period. How does a nuclear explosion, a bomb going off, differ from radiation leaking from a power plant?
Well, I think there's two things to look at. There's the short-term immediate impact, and there's the long-term contamination. A nuclear bomb, in terms of short-term impact, is nothing like a nuclear reactor, even something as dangerous as Chernobyl. Chernobyl didn't flash people into instant death the way a nuclear bomb does. So, no, it's nothing like a nuclear bomb. It's a slow release of radioactive isotopes. The scenarios in which there's large amounts of radiation dispersed by a nuclear plant crisis is only when some kind of explosion from steam or hydrogen or something else that will release big clouds of material into the air, and then the wind disperses those materials over an area.
Now, are those materials, or would they have a longer life than a nuclear bomb?
Well, the nuclear bomb is a more complete fission reaction, so there are less of the longer-lived, like plutonium isotopes.
So a lot of that burns up in the explosion.
Yeah.
One of the other reasons that anti-nuclear activists give for not looking towards nuclear energy as a solution, an alternative to coal, oil, and gas, is that we don't know what to do with the spent fuel.
Yeah, so when they say we don't know what to do with it, that's not all true. We don't know what to do with it on geologic timescales. We do know what to do with it in the short term, and we have options to minimize it. France reprocesses their nuclear fuel or spent nuclear waste. That creates much smaller quantities of the high-level, long-lived radioactive waste that you're worried about. They're able to store it in one building there in France.
And we hear a lot about Yucca Mountain in Nevada.
So what stopped Yucca Mountain is mostly a political issue, and that, you know, Nevada and Senator Harry Reid are, you know, have been opposed to citing the geologic storage there. But so there's one thing that just important context for when we talk about nuclear waste, and this is something I had no idea until I started to look into it. And you always knew that uranium is much more energy dense than coal. You know, you get a lot more energy out of a small amount of uranium. I had no idea how much more energy dense. It's 5 to 7 orders of magnitude more. So that's zeros, 5 to 7 zeros more. So that means that in the total of all nuclear fuel consumption in the history of nuclear power in the United States, 50 years of nuclear power, that now provides about a fifth of our electricity, we've created a few thousand tons of nuclear waste, about 50,000 tons of nuclear waste. That could be stored, the high-level waste from that, the dangerous stuff, could be stored in dry cask storage containers that fit on about 2 football fields of space. That's it, from all the nuclear power that we've generated in 50 years. The reality is it is a very small problem. It's a manageable, local, small quantity of waste. Now, we know what to do with that on a short time, centuries time scale. We put them in dry cask storage, and we store them at a secure site. And that will prevent radiative release. It'll prevent public health impacts. You could have that in your backyard, and you would see no impact. I would much rather live right next to the spent fuel storage site and dry cask storage than I would an oil refinery or a coal plant.
Jesse Jenkins, the Director of Energy and Climate at the Breakthrough Institute. It's a nonprofit, independent public policy think tank. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's great.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Tom Frund, Grateful Dead, and Melvin Van Peebles. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.